Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this St. Patrick's Day, 17th of March. It's Monday, all things political coming up this hour. But don't you worry, we will celebrate St. Patrick's Day, hour number two. Frank Delaney, who's been called the most eloquent man in the world, was with us last year and the year before and the year before. And last year we said, same time next year, and he'll be with us. Hour two of our program today. Mondays at 1, we always have all things political. We have a lot of issues to look at, starting with the international situation in Crimea. Our guest this hour is Yevgeny Feyman, fellow at the Manhattan Institute. He writes on health care policy, entitlement reform, and the Affordable Care Act. His latest research has focused on the national physician shortage and the costs of health care reform. So, of course, during this hour, we'll be talking about the number of people who have signed up for the Affordable Care Act, how many people are now insured, if the uninsured rate has gone down significantly. Yesterday, Crimea voted to secede from Ukraine. Today, President Obama froze the U.S. assets of 7 Russian officials, including top advisors to President Vladimir Putin. We will also this hour be talking about the deal that was struck, bipartisan deal, last Thursday that would renew federal unemployment benefits for the long-term jobless. But it remains up in the air what the House will do with this. GM cars, I want to talk about that story, which I don't think is receiving much attention. GM saying last week that it had received reports as early as 2001, 3 years earlier than previously disclosed, of a safety defect in cars that the company has now linked to 12 deaths and at least 31 accidents over the past decade, and nothing was done about it. And also, our guest wants to talk about how the Ukraine troubles are affecting the Eurozone crisis. So a lot to discuss this hour. For you to join our conversation, the number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org, Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. You can leave your poems there, too. And our Twitter is @KDunnShow. Yevgeny Feyman, thank you very much for being with us. Hello.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, our pleasure. Well, let's start with Crimea, where they voted, no surprise here, to secede from Ukraine. I wonder what you think about the actions that the president took today and the European Union announcing travel bans and freezing assets on 21 people linked to the unrest. Does that seem like a sufficient response to you?
Oh, not even close. It's way too little, way too late. You know, if you've been threatening sanctions and travel bans for for months before this, these officials have managed to shift their assets to other countries offshore to the Cayman Islands. And at this point, this is purely a nominal thing.
What should be done?
Wow, that's a tough question. You know, there are a lot of options. I think politically, it's very difficult to deal with someone like Vladimir Putin. He's operating under a different mindset than U.S. leaders are traditionally used to. He's operating under a different mindset than European leaders are used to. I think one of the most effective ways we can start isolating Russia and really punishing them is credibly showing that we're willing to export oil and natural gas as a substitute for Russian oil and natural gas in Europe. If you cut off their economic partners, the EU and Ukraine, that would be a huge blow, but it has to be credible, and that's the hard part about this.
Mm-hmm. So we export oil? Is that what you're saying?
We currently don't. It's currently illegal for us to export crude oil or natural gas to non-free trade agreement countries. That means most countries in the world that want our natural gas or want our crude oil can't receive it. If we had been exporting crude oil or natural gas to Ukraine and the rest of the EU for many years before this, Ukraine wouldn't be in the position they are right now. It wouldn't be as severe.
Mm-hmm. Do we have enough oil to do that?
You know, the estimates of our reserves keep growing every single year. Same thing goes for our natural gas. It would be easier to export our oil at any given time because more companies are willing to do that. Natural gas, the first export terminal probably wouldn't be ready till 2015, 2016. So in the short term, it would be oil. Long term, it's natural gas.
So the European Union travel bans and asset freezes are not very much because they're dependent on the oil from Russia. Does it go beyond that at all?
I think there's a lot going on here. So the travel bans are probably a minor hindrance. They won't be able to come to the U.S. They probably wouldn't be coming to the U.S. anyway, or the rest of the EU countries that have agreed to these sanctions. In terms of the economic effect, like I said, they've shifted their assets. Any further effect from these sanctions will be limited, I think, because the U.S. and their sanctions against Iran, for years, I think three years ago they began. We've been very, very willing to offer exceptions to companies that request them. And so those sanctions became much less effective than they could have been.
Mm-hmm. What do you imagine Putin has in mind here, or is it pretty hard for us to decipher what he's up to?
So I'll admit up front, I'm a little biased here. I'm a Russian Jew. I emigrated from Russia a long time ago.
Oh, you did?
I did. So my view of this is certainly a little bit skewed, but I think he's in some ways trying to replicate Hitler's advance in World War II that began World War II. Hitler knew that he would be unimpeded in moving on Eastern Europe, and this is Putin's mindset. He knows that Western leaders want to avoid conflict at all costs, and he loves that. He's seeking power, influence, and he knows that Western leaders don't want to engage in military intervention to stop him.
Mm. When did your family and why did your family decide to leave Russia, Yevgeny?
So we left in 1994, shortly after the breakup of the Soviet Union. We actually left as refugees, and mainly because we're Jewish. Being Jewish in Russia is very, very difficult, even now.
Mm-hmm. Can you talk more about that? How so?
Yeah. My mother's experience, I think, growing up in Russia and going to school there, she wanted to go to med school. And the refrain she always heard from admission counselors and then the people in charge of the schools is that, a Jew is not going to get into the school. So she ended up becoming a translator. Here she became a nurse. But the opportunities for advancement for a Jew in Russia were abysmal during the Soviet Union. They haven't gotten much better now.
Mm. Do you worry at all that all this is going to lead to some kind of major military confrontation between the U.S. and Russia?
I think if that were to happen, it would be much further off. I think we're very committed towards trying to resolve this diplomatically. Russia certainly doesn't want a military confrontation, while their army is very, very big and certainly strong. They recognize that Western armies have a much stronger advantage. At the same time, we should be avoiding a military confrontation at all costs because we have to deal with China at the same time as all of this. China's a very, very strong economic partner. Even though they're somewhat of a rival, we don't want to mess up our relations with them long term. They do hold a lot of our debt. They're going to prove an invaluable economic partner going further, and I think a more trustworthy partner than Russia. So long term, there might be military repercussions. I hope they're going to be limited. In the near term, I don't think there will be any.
I know that you wanted to discuss, and I'm happy to hear this because I haven't seen a lot of press, on how the Ukraine troubles are affecting the Eurozone crisis.
Sure. So, in terms of sanctions, when it comes to diplomatic and economic ways of dealing with Russia, the fact that the Eurozone is so weak right now makes a lot of their potential policies, first of all, less credible. That's hugely important when you're at the negotiating table. The people you're negotiating with have to believe that you can credibly implement policies that hurt them. So their economic weakness makes those policies less credible. But as we've seen with these sanctions that did pass, the PIGS countries, Portugal, Italy, Greece, Spain, they were very reticent about applying a much broader range of sanctions that would have hit over 100 people. Poland wanted to add a few people to that list, but they were rejected at the last minute. So this ongoing Eurozone crisis, the slow growth, tight monetary policy, still relatively high unemployment, it's contributing to the fact that the Eurozone, first of all, can't react well to Russia's aggression. But it also means that their dependence on Russia is much more salient during all these events.
Mm-hmm. Let's move, although the audience, feel free to call in whenever you'd like. All of these subjects, we'd love to hear your comments on 800-486-8655. Let's move to the Affordable Care Act. I know your expertise is on health benefits, shortage of doctors, et cetera. Article in Forbes from a couple days ago has this as the first paragraph. I wonder what you think of it. Health benefits consultants agree with President Obama's assessment this week that enough Americans have signed up to private health plans under the Affordable Care Act that it will work, even though there could be up to 2 million fewer Americans covered than the White House had hoped. Do you agree?
You know, that's a difficult statement to make, I think, this early in the game. I think 3 years down the line, after 2016, we'll have a much better picture of the so-called steady state of enrollment, really how many people are going to be on these exchanges. But the way I look at it is this. The individual market before Obamacare, before the ACA, consisted of about 15 million people. Right now, we know that there are about 4.2, maybe a little more, people signed up on the exchanges. So in my mind, if you don't at least surpass the size of the individual market before the ACA, you can't argue that you have a stable market under the ACA.
You have done a great deal of research into the physician shortage in this country. Does the ACA cover that at all? And how significant a shortage do we have?
Well, the shortage is tremendous.
Is it?
Especially when it comes to the primary care physician.
Uh-huh.
We simply don't have enough capacity to meet all the demand for healthcare services that's going to appear in the coming decade, two decades especially. The ACA actually doesn't add very much to it. It adds probably about 15% or so of the expected shortage. Much more of it has to do with demographic factors, the aging population. We're discovering new diseases, Alzheimer's, for instance, which is pretty much an old age disease. So as a result of aging, we're getting sicker. And caring for those diseases, managing people with those chronic conditions is very difficult. You need more and more doctors. Now, let me actually step back a little bit. You don't necessarily need doctors. You could have nurse practitioners take up a lot of what primary care physicians do. But in most states, what nurse practitioners can do is very limited. It helps protect a lot of the physician associations from competition. So There's a lot we can do without necessarily increasing the physician supply. We could reduce some of the regulations that prevent competition against physicians, but something has to be done as soon as possible.
And what about the pay for primary care physicians? I have talked to people who have said everybody's going into the specialty areas because you can make a whole lot more money if you go that route.
Absolutely. And there's a really good reason for that. Medicare uses something called the RBRVS. It's a payment standard where payments for different services are based on their quote-unquote relative value. And traditionally, this payment system has underpaid for evaluation management services, which basically fall under the scope of primary care, and they tend to overpay for specialty services. So it's easy to see how that happens in Medicare. How that translates to the private insurance market is that insurers typically follow Medicare in terms of their relative pricing of services. So if Medicare increases pricing for one service relative to the other, insurers will pay more relatively for that service than they will for other services. And we know that Medicare doesn't do a good job of discerning which are high-value services and which are low-value services.
Why doesn't somebody do a really thorough investigation of how much money is involved in the whole healthcare system and where there may be duplication and why the prices are so high? Has that been done?
Yeah, absolutely. Most recently, I think, there was a researcher from the Rand Corporation. He did a terrific analysis, and I think at minimum he found somewhere around $90 billion of waste in Medicare annually. Upper range estimates go as high as 30-40% of Medicare's total spending. So if you apply that to the healthcare system as a whole, which is a little more difficult, we do waste a lot of money. There's a lot of duplicative spending, and there are all sorts of reasons for that, ranging from administrative duplications to the fact that insurers don't really have an incentive to invest in long-term care and in in improvements to a person's long-term health, because they generally don't keep that person on for very long. So they don't have much of an incentive in saving Medicare money, because once that person turns 65, the insurers don't have to worry about them.
And when you say $90 billion going to waste in Medicare, what is that based on? What are the wasteful services?
So a lot of this has to do with things like CAT scans, MRIs. Those are typically very, very expensive services relative to the value that we get from them. Now, don't get me wrong, an MRI is very, very useful. If you've done an X-ray and the X-ray doesn't show what the problem is, if you might have suspected a broken bone, the X-ray doesn't resolve it, you want to investigate a little further, you might do an MRI or a CT scan, then it is valuable. But if you just jump right into an MRI, or you give an MRI to someone just for the hell of it because, you know, you suspect there might be something wrong but there's not much evidence, that's wasteful spending. But Medicare and other insurers tend to pay fairly high rates for those MRIs. The same goes for other radiology procedures. And it shows in national numbers. We have more MRI machines per capita than any other country in the world, and by a huge margin.
But certainly that's not just Medicare's problem. Certainly
no,
that must run across the board.
There's absolutely more to it. There's fraud in Medicare. Now, trying to figure out what's fraud, what isn't, intentional and what isn't. So you might have someone actively defrauding Medicare, or it might be that Medicare's administrators just overpaid for something when they shouldn't have. Trying to separate those out can be pretty difficult. The Government Accountability Office a few years back did an analysis of Medicare and Medicaid, and they estimated somewhere about $40 to $45 billion of fraud in each program. So altogether, it's about $90 billion. Again, that could be taken as a low-end estimate, a mid-range estimate. It's hard to say because, as I said, it is very difficult to identify what is and what isn't fraud.
Hmm. We want to talk about the Obama health care program being the focus of the special election in Florida's 13th district, which we talked about last week, and the Republican one who campaigned against the Affordable Care Act. What does that mean for midterm elections and how potent an issue that is for Republicans? We'll talk about as we continue. We're going to welcome phone calls, and we'll take them momentarily. Our guest on All Things Political is Yevgeny Feyman. He's a fellow at the Manhattan Institute, writing on healthcare policy, entitlement reform, Affordable Care Act. He has written for a number of publications, including National Review Online, FoxNews.com, The Washington Examiner, Politico, and has spoken on programs all over the country. To your phone calls momentarily. Here's our number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, Twitter at K Dunn Show. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening now to All Things Political. We've talked about the vote in Crimea. We have talked about the response from the President of the United States and the European Union, how this has affected the Eurozone. We're talking about health care, and our list of topics will expand as we carry on. Right now, let's go to phone calls, starting with Jerry in Onalaska. Hi, Jerry.
Hi.
Hi.
I wonder if you'd respond to something that occurred to me in our earlier discussion of what to do about Russia, how to put more pressure on them. What would happen, what do you think would happen if we were to drop out ourselves, drop out of the G8, since the Europeans will not agree to, you know, throw Russia out? We would drop out and we would form a new organization called the G7. I don't think the Europeans would prefer to be left alone with the Russians in the old G8. I think they'd probably move over to the G7. It would be another way of basically getting Russia out of the G8. Think that might work?
You know, that's a great question. I think absolutely that's a great move. It's certainly on the table right now. EU leaders might be reticent about it. They might be cautious right now. But I think when it comes down to it, they're okay with it. They recognize that Russia is a threat. I don't think they recognize just how much of a threat it is. But I think anything that excludes Russia a little more, that shows Russia that to play in the international community, you have to follow the international community's rules. Anything that does that is a good thing. G7, 100%.
Anything else, Jerry?
Well, I might ask one more.
All right.
You know, here we are. We're very interested in Europe, and we're kind of worried about Europe. Really, this situation has very little to do with us. It has a lot to do with Europe. I sometimes wonder, you know, we're ready to sacrifice perhaps some economic employment or whatever will resolve from this. But what is Europe willing to sacrifice for us? I sometimes worry that Europe may not be the greatest treaty partner, that we might be able and willing to come to their aid, but are they able and willing to come to our aid?
So, again, I think it's a good point, and I've heard this a few times from people who are very concerned about us intervening in foreign affairs. I think we should absolutely be cautious about how much we expose ourselves to other countries' problems, but this also stems from a treaty we signed with Ukraine in 1994. Ukraine gave up its nukes. That was a huge sacrifice in exchange for the U.S. and other countries agreeing to support Ukraine's territorial sovereignty. Now, if we show that we won't abide by international treaties like that, it's going to be very difficult for us to get agreements from countries in the future. A lot of it has to do with credibility that the U.S., as the unipolar superpower in the world, will stand by its foreign commitments and will protect its allies when it's called upon to do so.
Thank you, Jerry, very much for your great questions. Jean is next. Hi, Jean.
Hi. I think Jerry has said something that I didn't know about our treaty with Ukraine. But before I was mulling over that, I was going to say I do not understand this big hoopla, upgeverf, about the people of Crimea wanting to decide where they lived or whom they lived under. I understand that Crimea was given to the Ukraine by somebody like Khrushchev or something, just given. And to me, the Crimea has always belonged to Russia. I'm not Russian. I don't have any, you know, historical investment in it. But I just wonder what, aside from Russia, is supposed to be the big bad guy. I would like to know why Russia is still the big bad guy. I can think of much bigger, worse guys.
Okay, thank you, Jean.
So, you know, absolutely, Russia's not the worst country out there. North Korea, I think, ranks much higher on that list. I think one of the major issues with what's happening in Crimea is a question of whether the minorities in Crimea are going to receive adequate protection. Historically, it has actually been a Russian province, but there's been a very vocal and very, very important minority that has ethnic ties to the land, the Crimean Tatars, which are a Muslim sect. And they're rightfully worried that with a province returning back to Russia, they're going to be treated like they were under Russian rule, which saw them deported to Siberian labor camps. It saw them punished for not being Russian. And I think these are all valid concerns. There are also concerns about Ukraine's territorial sovereignty and how people are going to view their constitution, which makes this referendum illegal. There are a lot of moving parts here. And although on the surface it seems like this is a popular movement, there are a lot of people funding it from both sides. There's a lot of Russian involvement to push Crimea back to Russia. So based on what little we know, it's very difficult for me to say whether it's 100% a good thing or a bad thing, but there are a lot of concerns.
I would imagine if Putin goes beyond Crimea, all hell breaks loose, do you think?
Well, you know, he's already did. They're landing troops, and these are acknowledged as Russian troops on the southern border of mainland Ukraine. So they're already off the peninsula. And again, the refrain from Putin's administration is that this is to protect ethnic Russians, to make sure that the right-wing nationalist parties don't start attacking people indiscriminately. But, you know, the international community is letting him get away with it. He's still moving deeper. He's testing the waters.
Thanks very much, Gene, for your call. Chris in Green Bay is next. Hi, Chris.
Hello. I'd like to weigh in on the Obamacare and the impact that it's had on me and my particular work situation. Well, what it's done is it's created a disincentive for me to work extra overtime. My employer provides very good insurance to me, and overtime is regularly available. And, you know, if in the year, if I'm able to make an extra $5,000 with that overtime, because this is not a premium, it's a tax, they're taking $800 more out of, say, $5,000 that I earn. Well, that $800 is money I can use for my family, you know, and our needs and my retirement. You know, just doesn't seem right that they're coming after me, somebody that's not too far out of the, you know, from the bottom. I'm working my backside off to provide for my family, and they're penalizing me.
But how is Obama?
I don't think that's right.
How is Obamacare responsible for that? Your employer is taking care of your health insurance, right?
Well, right now, but you know, he's pushed this thing back. You know, to where my employer, you know, I think he pushed it back 2 years now, just for politics, and it's coming though. You know, my employer will kick me off and throw me into the exchanges.
Oh, is that what?
And that'll be the situation that I just described.
It's
because I've seen the tables.
It's a small business.
The tables say that I'm going to be paying more.
Yeah, are you in a small?
Less.
Are you in a small business, Chris? You work for a small business?
No, I work for a rather large business. And
okay, maybe I'm missing something here. Am I missing something, Yevgeny? On
well, so what can happen at some businesses when they employ more than 50 full-time workers, that then they're required to provide insurance to all of them.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there's a slight delay there that's been put in recently by the administration to allow quote-unquote medium-sized businesses, so between 50 and 90 and 100 workers, to delay by an extra year offering health insurance. So that's part of it. But generally, you know, the businesses over 50, if they don't offer insurance to all their full-time employees, they have to pay a penalty, $2,000 per worker. Because the cost of insurance generally is increasing, even for big companies, there's some new mandates in the law that will increase the cost of insurance. For smaller companies, you know, say 55, 60 employees, those costs are also going to be salient. In some cases, it will make it profitable for those businesses to drop coverage, pay the penalty for each worker that gets a subsidy, and let their workers go to the exchange.
Do you? But there's no reason for Chris to believe that's going to happen right now, is there? I mean, we don't. Do you imagine a lot of big companies are going to do that?
So big companies, really big companies, probably not. But there are different loopholes that they can exploit. If you offer a mini-med plan, which is technically not allowed under Obamacare, it's only allowed if you also offer a full comprehensive plan. The employees can sign up to the mini-med plan, and then they have to pay the penalty, but the employer doesn't. There are some really interesting ways to exploit the law. It's not necessarily the case that Obamacare is causing this employer to drop coverage. Employers make decisions about health insurance every year. Before the Affordable Care Act, it'll continue after. And, you know, really what employers should be doing if they choose to stop offering health insurance, if they pull it, workers should be seeing some kind of a raise. With a penalty, that makes it more difficult. But even then, because they don't have to pay for health benefits anymore, they can devote more compensation to cash wages.
Thanks, Chris, for your call. Ray in Milwaukee. Hi.
Issue.
I'm sorry, Ray. What did you say?
What I find stunning is we have this little prison in Guantanamo Bay where we torture people, we kidnap people from around the world. We hold them indefinitely and also inhumanely on a foreign on foreign land so that we don't have to follow America's laws about imprisoning people? And where do we get off telling the Russians what they can and cannot do with a former province of theirs? All Vladimir Putin should say is Guantanamo Bay and torture, and come back to me when you've straightened that mess up.
Yevgeny.
So I agree completely that Guantanamo Bay is a black mark on the United States history. It's a gross human rights violation. The fact that we've let it continue for as long as it has is abysmal. We're depriving people of their lives and liberties. We've imprisoned people falsely. These aren't only terrorists there. So I completely agree. It should be scaled down, wound down as soon as possible. It will be difficult to figure out what to do with some of the actual combatants that are being held there now. They will have to be tried, so we'll have to figure out a process for that. But that's something we should be working on rather than putting it off indefinitely. Now, that being said, I think the scale of what we've done at Guantanamo doesn't even begin to approach the scale of what Putin has done. And this encompasses not only Ukraine, but this encompasses Georgia in 2008 as well. This is a pattern that the Putin administration has been engaged in. They're really testing the waters to see how much they can get away with. And what they're doing in Ukraine is very clearly a violation of international law. The United Nations is powerless to do anything because Russia is one of the permanent five members. They would veto it. I certainly agree that it's a little bit hypocritical of us to tell other countries that they're engaged in human rights violations. But just because we have a black mark doesn't mean we shouldn't point out when other countries are engaging in much worse practices than what we've done.
Well, we've certainly had enough years to figure this out, haven't we? This has been a long time.
Absolutely, and it's disgraceful. I do want to point out that the Supreme Court has actually said that Guantanamo Bay does qualify as U.S. soil when it comes to jurisdiction. So we do have jurisdiction judicially over Guantanamo Bay. That's why we did try to implement military tribunals before. That didn't work out very well. And figuring out how to try the people housed in Guantanamo Bay in civilian courts is really a mess.
Yeah.
It's very difficult.
Neil in Madison, hello.
Hello. I'm curious about Evgeny's take on the modification of Ray's point. Not only did we invade Iraq and sort of undermine our moral authority to oppose any of Putin's ambitions in the Ukraine, but by invading Iraq and being there for 10 years, we've blunted our military's ability to respond in Ukraine, and I'd be curious to get Evgeny's take on that.
Thanks, Neil.
So I want to give an example. Let's take two world states. So in one world state, in both world states, we've invaded Afghanistan, we've invaded Iraq, and we've allowed Guantanamo Bay to exist for as long as it has. So we're on morally dubious ground. In world state one, we let Russia do whatever they want in Europe, potentially extend further into Ukraine, and get Ukraine to capitulate to Russia's demands. In world state two, we accept that we've done things that are morally indefensible, but we still want to try to make the world a better place wherever possible. So we tell Russia, you can't do this. This isn't how a honest player in international politics acts. I think that even though there's some hypocrisy involved, the second world state, where we do try to prevent more damage to Ukraine, to a former Soviet satellite, is preferable than the one where we don't.
It is interesting, if you look at polls of the American public, there isn't much enthusiasm for doing much of anything, and it must be because of Iraq and our long period of time in Afghanistan. We're just not wholeheartedly behind too many actions, are we?
Absolutely, and I think that when it comes down to it, that's a good thing. It's good that Americans are skeptical of military intervention. If it comes to military intervention or even just having boots on the ground, the best thing that can happen is for it to either be UN peacekeepers or for it to be NATO troops, as we did in Libya. What happened in Libya certainly wasn't good. the outcome there was far from what we wanted. I think NATO troops have learned from that. I think they could potentially stabilize the situation in Ukraine, again, if it really came down to it, which I hope that it won't.
You're listening to All Things Political here on the Ideas Network, and we're going to take more phone calls. We have yet to talk about, I want to talk about this GM story in the minutes that remain as well, and they say they were told of this ignition defect in 2001, 3 years earlier than they said they had been notified. Doesn't make any difference. They didn't do anything, and people died as a result of these cars, you know, driving down the road, and the ignition turns off. So what happened with that? Is there some agency, federal agency, that's not doing its job? We also want to, I forgot, we got to get to this Florida's 13th special election and how big this issue of Affordable Care Act will be for the Republicans and what issue will work for Democrats as we get, you know, pretty close now to the midterm elections. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@WPR.org. Our Facebook page is the Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter at K Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network for St. Patrick's Day of Wisconsin Public Radio. Before we go back to phone calls, this is a Facebook message that came in. Yevgeny, we talked last week about Florida's, just briefly, Florida's 13th special election vote on all things political. This listener said, after hearing you talk about Florida's 13th, I heard Robert Gibbs, former White House press spokesperson, on the Sunday morning show make the following comment. After what happened in the Florida election, the Democrats will need to get their act together or they can just turn the lights out at the White House for the next 2 years. Gibbs said that you're allowed to be much more realistic in your statements once you're outside the White House rather than inside the administration. What do you make of that?
I think he's definitely right. Once you're outside the administration, you can say things that you would never be allowed to when you were in. I think on the one hand, this definitely should give Democrats a bit of a run for their money. They certainly can't just sit safely and take solace in knowing that 2012 was a quote-unquote referendum on the ACA. At the same time, I don't think Republicans should oversell the support for their position of purely being anti-Obamacare. The race was pretty close, and a third-party candidate, the Libertarian Party candidate, did get 5% of the vote there, which is pretty significant for a third party. Republicans will have to come in with a legitimate either replacement option or legitimate fixes to the law that are significant enough to put their names on and defend politically. They certainly can't come back in with a pure anti-Obamacare message, and Democrats, to be safe politically, will have to accept that changes are going to have to happen to the law, possibly significant changes that they might not like.
And have you seen a good and thorough replacement?
You know, I've seen a few. Republicans certainly have offered a lot of varieties of Obamacare that are similar, some with the different changes, some plans that are completely different from Obamacare. So some of them are better than others. The GOP is working right now on putting out more of a grand plan that will take into account all these other plans and incorporate the best parts of all of them. I think they're certainly going to have this ready for the midterm elections. I just hope that what comes out is realistic and isn't just a political ploy.
And what do you think plays for the Democrats in the midterms?
I'm sorry?
What messages play well for the Democrats?
Well, so Democrats are certainly going to try to play up the positive effects of the ACA, and as well they should. They're going to find people who were unable to get coverage before or who had to pay a lot for coverage before and now can get more affordable coverage. They're going to find people who have become eligible for Medicaid expansion. And those are going to be the most salient political points they can make. It's going to be these human interest stories, these very personal stories of people who are benefiting from the law. Republicans are certainly going to counter with stories of people who are being hurt by the law, and there are people being hurt by the law. But it's going to have to be much more nuanced than that. They're going to have to explain how their proposal will make those people better off.
Hmm. Scott in New Glarus, our next caller. Hi.
Yes, hello. A couple points if I have time. I'm wondering what the percentage of eligible voter turnout was in that Florida election. And then I have a thought on what it might take to get Democrats, if they didn't turn out in big numbers, what it would take to motivate them in the midterms.
You know, I'm not actually sure what the eligible voter turnout was in Florida. I imagine it's probably no different than what we see nationally. It may have been a little bit higher because it was such a high-profile race. I'm sorry, your second question was what can motivate Democratic voters to come out in the midterms?
Well, people are so disgusted with both parties. You know, the polls show they don't like the Democrats, they don't like the Republicans, they haven't gotten anything done, they're upset with Obama. I think there are a lot of quotes, open statements about the main goal of Republicans is to, first, make Obama a one-term president, and secondly, and additionally, to foil him at every possible step that they can. And they've avowed this. They've said it openly many, many times. I'm wondering if the Democrats can somehow show that this has been the whole modus operandi of the Republicans and say, this is why you're disgusted with nothing being done. They're being obstructionists from A to Z for the last 6 years. And to fight against that, we need to get more Democrats in the Senate and the Congress.
Right. You know, I'm not sure if that's necessarily a winning message for Democrats, mainly because the response from Republicans is simply going to be one of, look at the economy, look at jobs. And this has been an anemic recovery. Now, you certainly can't lay that at the feet of the administration solely. There are all sorts of structural problems going on. But the Republican response, I think, would be much more salient, much stronger than the criticism of Republicans being purely obstructionist. I think people respond much better to messages regarding the economy and jobs, and it would certainly be a messaging war that the Democrats lose, in my mind.
Thank you, Scott, for the call. Let's talk about what might appear to be a rare bipartisan deal that was struck last night by Senate negotiators. 10 senators, evenly divided among Democrats and Republicans, announcing this renewal of federal unemployment benefits and setting up a timeline under which the legislation could pass the Senate in late March. The outcome in the House, of course, remains up in the air. Is this a sign, positive sign, of good things to come, of a bipartisan nature, or not?
I doubt it. It was a bipartisan deal because I think five Republican senators agreed to it. So you managed to get a few Republicans. I don't think the House is going to go for it broadly. They're very opposed to expanding unemployment insurance and reauthorizing it and giving people retroactive payments. The economic evidence here is very mixed. Studies from a decade ago show that unemployment insurance does lead people to stay unemployed longer. On the other hand, more recent research that focuses on economic downturn periods like the one we're in shows that it's not really that people are choosing to stay unemployed. It's that the demand for their labor just isn't there. A lot of these people were working in industries that have contracted a lot since the recession, and so it's what we call frictional unemployment. They're still looking, they're still trying to retrain themselves, looking for new jobs.
And this GM story, I don't think this is getting a lot of play. And as I recalled last week, we gave this company a lot of money.
We
taxpayers did. GM, receiving New York Times report March 12, they said GM saying last Wednesday it had received reports as early as 2001, 3 years earlier than previously disclosed, of a safety defect in its cars that the company has now linked to 12 deaths and at least 31 accidents over the past decade. I imagine those numbers are smaller than what the reality is. What in the world is this story? Why didn't they recall these vehicles? And this has been such a long period of time. People died.
It's terrible. It looks like the company looked at these at these defects, and they looked at the cost-benefit analysis and said it's not worth it to recall them. It may have been before they knew about these deaths. I really hope it was. If it wasn't, I think this is grounds for a criminal investigation to figure out who dropped the ball, who was supposed to report this to the NHTSA, the National Highway
Right.
Traffic Safety Administration. I think that our legal system provides a lot of opportunities for people to seek damages from GM. Class action suit is in the works. We have a very powerful system of torts to compensate people. Now, the people who have lost loved ones or friends because of this, they should stay away from these class action suits. I think it needs to be a criminal investigation. You need to put the people responsible for this in jail because it's negligence.
It is, yeah. Randy is next. Hi, Randy.
Hello. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
I am calling in regard to some of the comments made earlier in the program about the culpability of one government versus another and how we treat our citizenry in foreign countries or our own.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm really disillusioned because I believe that one of the Nazi war criminals was pointing out as he was being prosecuted, what difference does it make if we kill 1,000 or 1 million, you know, we're still killing them. And I'm really disturbed about NPR's view and their political guests that they bring on that are just—it just seems like they're pro-warmongers pretty consistently. And with that, I'll take your comment off the air.
Well, I'm not sure what you want us to comment on. I don't think I would call you a warmonger.
I'm certainly not a warmonger. I apologize if I've given that impression. I don't support military intervention when it comes down to it. I think wars hurt everyone much more than any one country can benefit. I think it's terrible that we live in an age where governments can still violate the territorial sovereignty of others and kill people in the name of seeking influence. That being said, we live in an imperfect world, and I think whatever we can do to limit the aggression of dishonest actors like Russia or like North Korea, even if we're on less than noble ground ourselves, I think it's worth taking that action.
Thank you very much for the call. I saved this till last because heavens knows the media is consumed with this story. But this Malaysian Airlines story, I don't know what people will do when the airline isn't found. I don't know how it's going to be found, but it has absorbed so much airtime, hasn't it? Do you have any comment that we haven't heard before about this? Is this a story we should be concerned about?
You know, it's terrible.
It is terrible.
In an age where we can track anything, anywhere, we have RFID chips on individual packages that we could track through the entire supply chain as they're being shipped and received, you know, to for an airplane to just literally disappear out of the sky. It's shocking. I'm not an aviation expert. I wish I could I could really offer a more intelligent comment on it, but it's terrible. I feel for the families. That's all I can really say.
Yeah. One more phone call briefly. Carl in Mexico. Hi.
Hi there. Yeah, well, back to U.S. Problems, USA problems here. Who do you blame for where we're at? Remember, we have a minimum of 80% of non-participants in voting in the U.S. That's the statistic. Sadly, the maximum voters are 20%. And so who do you blame? It's the people who don't participate. And also, whoever's listening, well, remember, don't just vote. Be informed and give your ideas to make things better. Don't just gripe about things. Griping is the first step. And then what is your idea to make things work? Get involved. I've got things done positively on both sides of the border.
All right, and, Carl. And call us, too. You know, that's why we're here, to hear from you. Well, thank you so much, Yevgeny, for being
My
with
pleasure.
Us. Covered a lot of issues.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, our pleasure. Our guest this hour, you have Evgeny Feyman. He is a fellow at the Manhattan Institute, writes on a number of issues, is obviously informed on a number, but his special areas are healthcare policy, entitlement reform, and the Affordable Care Act. And we thank him for being with us. Thanks to Cynthia Schuster for producing the hour. Thanks to K.P. Whaley, who's back from vacation this week. Missed him. And thanks for all of your calls, everybody. We're going to celebrate St. Patrick's Day. You don't have to be Irish to love the poetry and the music and the guest, Frank Delaney. It will be a good time coming up.